I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I'm one of your hosts, Phil Iscove.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in this week for your regular host, the metal band Slayer, who had to recuse themselves for obvious conflict of interest reasons.
Totally fair, totally fair. With us today, Joanne Robinson, back, finally back on the mic to talk with us today about the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Not, we'll talk about the television show as well, I'm sure, but I reached out to you a few months ago and I was like, would love to come have you come on for 1992. You said of course, and you gave me a list of films that you would be interested in talking about. This was one of them. I know you're a big Buffy fan of the television show.
Yes, correct.
I don't know what your thoughts are on the film. We're obviously going to find that out today. But did you rewatch this before talking about this?
Of course, yes.
That wasn't a quiz. I just mean, I'm curious now. I'm assuming it's been a beat since you've watched this film, or have you watched it relatively recently?
It's been a beat, but I wouldn't say it hasn't been since 1992 that film. But yeah, it had been a minute. But I mean, this might be skipping ahead to another question you have, I saw this movie for the first time when I was 12 at a sleepover. I have such a strong memory of that. Mm-hmm. And it was a very important movie to me for some reason. I loved this movie. And, you know, before the TV show was even a glimmer in my eye. And I loved this movie. So rewatching it this morning, which I did, I was like, oh, yeah, I still know all the lines. Because, like, not only did I watch it, I would, like, quote it endlessly. And, like, I had other friends who were really into it, too. I have no idea why. And, like, so I am incapable of giving, like, a clear-eyed... I don't think you brought me on here to give you a clear-eyed review of this film. I have no perspective when it comes
That's
to
what
film,
Emily's for.
Sort of, like, but yeah, exactly.
I watched this last night for the first time ever. But I have very strong memories of seeing, like, an Entertainment Tonight package about this at my grandmother's house. And like, my grandmother was like the one person who would let me watch film and television. And I saw that and I was like, I gotta see that. And anyway, 30 some years later, I did.
You made it happen. Yeah.
You know, it is funny because I feel like I don't begin to suggest that I am a Buffy fanatic I did a Patreon episode with Jarrett Weisselman and Kelly Keeley Flaherty a few weeks ago, where we talked about, we compared and contrast two Buffy episodes, and they obviously can go very deep on that show. So within like Buffy lore, which I'm looking to you. Well, I guess you were also a Buffy fan, correct, Emily, from the show?
This is gonna. You remember how you and our guests were about Aaron Sorkin and A Few Good Men? Uh-huh. You were about to go there with me with Joss Whedon. He was my dude. I loved. He's like one of the formative creative figures of my life, and that's not a complicated thing at all now.
Not at all. No. And we will talk about that as well. But I do, the reason I bring this up is because it feels to me, at least to fans of the show, that this movie is kind of a redheaded stepchild, right? Like that it's not as, I mean, just because Joss has been so outspoken about his feelings about this film, I think that purists of the show seem to look at this movie as sort of a weaker thing. Am I crazy in that assessment?
No, definitely. But yeah, and I think that's true. Buffy is probably the most important show of my entire life, and Joss is very important to me, and it is extremely complicated, as Emily said. Sure. And we could talk about mm-hmm. as much of that yeah. or as little of that as sure. we want to, but I think what's true is, you know, Joss talks about, you know, frustrating lack of control around this film. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially he wanted to direct it. Something I did today that I'd never done is I read his original script and was sort of just like comparing it to the end product. It's not that different, really, right. from his original script. We can talk about some of the differences. And so I think he was just, you know, like a frustrated creative. I completely understand, and seemed to have very personal beef with Donald Sutherland, like specifically was a major issue. Yeah. So he doesn't like it. And I think if I were like a Joss acolyte mm-hmm. and he had done a bunch of other stuff and disdained this film, I would be like, justice for Joss. He didn't get to have his vision, but he got to make his Buffy. He had years and years and years to go deep on the lore. That's a lot of what cut was, like some vampire lore stuff. Like he went deep for years. So his Buffy exists. And so then I just like this as this like interesting curio. And I think an interesting thing to talk about when you compare and contrast is that this film's directed by a woman. And I think some of the changes that are made from his script, just like little tweaks to lines, is the input of a woman trying to tell a story of a teenage girl versus Joss, a man trying to tell a story of a teenage girl who's an insert for his own frustrations of feeling like ostracized. So that I think is an interesting part of it. But for Buffy purists who are like, the movie sucks, and especially like if you watch it maybe with no 90s nostalgia fondness around it or whatever, I can see how you would dismiss it. But I have not only 90s, I was 12 when I watched it, nostalgia for it, but also like 80s nostalgia for like the B movies that it is like obviously pulling from, or the cult movies like Highlander. Like there's a bunch of stuff that like I would watch on TBS late at night in the 90s that have their DNA all over this that I respond really well to. So
I mean, I certainly would not want to put words in Joss's mouth, but I do feel like there's a little bit of resentment as well, it feels like, in terms of some of the money that was made by some people off of this project mm-hmm. to some degree.
I didn't know Dolly Parton was involved. That's one of those things where does Dolly Parton get like $5 every time I buy some Buffy merch? Does that happen? I'm happy to enrich her.
Yeah, as am I. I mean, I think it's primarily Fran to some degree who you know, is obviously has sort of almost, you know, back end participation in the television show because of the movie. And I think there's a little bit of that might rankle him a little bit. Again, what's weird is that, so I watched this film yesterday. I hadn't seen it since I was also probably 12. My parents took me to see this film in theaters. And I only say that's weird because I remember going with my dad and my stepmom to see it. And this is not a movie that they would have any interest in seeing.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't imagine that I was the one that brought it up to them. So it was just one of those like, why this one, guys? Like, why did this happen?
Yeah.
But all that being said, I remember kind of liking it as a kid. And then obviously the show was the show, and I have not watched the movie since. So it was really interesting to watch it yesterday and sort of see what you're talking about, Joanna, of, you know, the Valley Girl thing that seemed to be a thing. And I'm curious as to where you guys come out on that, but also just like the tone of this movie isn't that far from the tone of the show. Like, it's a little dialed up and it's a little broader, but like, it's not that far from the show.
Season one, especially, I would say that the show eventually gets to a richer, deeper, darker place, especially, you know, the deeper you get in the run. Seasons five and six especially are pretty dark in many ways. I was someone who was a diehard fan of the show, had never seen the movie, was aware of it, you know, because of that Entertainment Tonight package. And when WB launched it, we didn't get WB where I lived. So I was like reading about it in Entertainment Weekly, and they were like, there's a Buffy the Vampire Slayer show. And I was like, but they made a movie of that, and that movie failed. And I was like, that's, why are they doing that? That should never happen. And now that's like all of entertainment. Like, that's just like, we're making TV shows of failed movies and you're going to like them. And I'm like, okay. The thing is, I'd never seen this. And when I watched it last night, I had come so far around on this TV show that is one of the most vital pop culture documents of my life. But now it's like, there's all these complicated feelings around it, that I could watch this and be like, yeah, that was okay.
Well, so I do have a question for you guys in terms of the show. What do you think it is about that show? And not just for you guys personally, because obviously I want to hear that too. But, you know, Buffy runs so deep, right? In terms of culture, in terms of kind of the ripple effect of shows that have been kind of ripping it off. And I don't even mean just within the genre space. I just mean in all sorts of different ways. I feel like it's had a huge impact. And yet, if you look at its ratings at the time, like, it was a modest size success, but it was by no means a cultural phenomenon in the way that, and maybe it's just all the friends that I have, but I mean, truly, all my friends are just like, it changed me. And I was like, so why do you think that is?
Well, are you talking about friends who are in the industry?
Well, yes, and also not, but sure.
I think, you know, a lot of people who then went into film and television look to this show as a cultural reset. The way that, you know, people also talk about Twin Peaks and a few other things, but the way in which Joss in the show space, and Emily, I'm sure, knows way more about this than I do, but like the introduction of the concept of the big bad, or the way in which long season long arcs mixed with monster of the week stories and all that sort of stuff felt like it was a reset in the way that we tell television. Also, this comes out a couple years before Dawson's Creek, but like the Kevin Williamson, Joss ease, like they're different, but they're similar in their sort of like, you know, very snarky, very pop culture based. This is not how real teens talk at all. That's like what my so-called life is for. This is, you know, this is like hyper reality, very clever, very witty, very smart, very fast. And so I think people who like become writers, you know, like, because not just in the film and TV industry, I've been working on this Marvel book for a million years, and like in the Joss chapter, I just like went through and found all the writers who cite Joss Whedon as like this seminal, important, game-changing, and, you know, you'll have high-end, you know, you'll have David Foster Wallace say it, you'll have David Simon say it, you'll have Shonda Rhimes say it, like all these people are saying the way in which Joss writes just sort of tickles something for people who love language. And then at its base, it's a show, you know, that this protagonist in the form of Buffy Summers, and then eventually like the Scooby gang around her, stuff like that, are so relatable in that the way the grand metaphor that he put together works so well of what if the monsters of your high school were literal monsters. And like a lot of people who felt like bookish and weird and outsider or fans of genre maybe felt that way. I'm interested in what you think, Emily, though.
I think you're right that it really changed a lot of how TV was plotted in a way that we like don't really realize, because it is just iterating on like what X-Files was doing, but it's like turning the screws And it's also throwing in a lot of X-Men comics because Whedon was hugely influenced by those. So he's taking the structure of comics, adding it to what X-Files was doing, and then playing it out across a TV season. And that's basically the invention of modern serialized television. Like, certainly other shows are mixed up in there, but Buffy's kind of where it first gets synthesized. It airs at a time when the internet is starting to be the predominant place where people talk about TV. Like Buffy, I think of Buffy, The Sopranos, and The West Wing as all kind of being part of this early, like, we're going to be discussed online to death. And Buffy's the one show that, like, embraces that. Like, Joss Whedon occasionally goes online and says stuff instead of writing episodes about Josh Lyman yelling at people who are posting online. I do think,
LemonLyman.com.
I do think, like, what is interesting about Whedon is that it is much easier to write bad Joss Whedon than it is to write bad Sorkin. Like, Sorkin's thing is so specific, and he frequently writes bad Sorkin. I don't want to, like, write that off, but, like, it's so specific that not a lot of other people are doing it, or if they do, it just obviously bad. Joss Whedon, like, the way his characters talk is now basically the way everybody in pop culture talks. But, like, when you go back and watch something he wrote, even this, which I think is not his finest work, like, there's a specificity and a timing and a precision to it that is so appealing to someone with, like, terminal writer brain, I think. At least people who are, like, very drawn to this sort of storytelling, which is not everyone. And I think that, you know, you read a lot of his interviews and it's just him complaining about actors not saying his lines right. Which to me, as someone, you know, who loves actors, is a little not great. Like, I think that's not the way that we should be working with our collaborators. But you get it because he's got such a specific ear for what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. And then the actors that can hit it, I think a lot about how he and J.J. Abrams are kind of also of this similar generation. And Abrams, I think, is better at casting overall. Like, Abrams found a whole bunch of people who went on to have huge careers, but Whedon is really good at casting actors who can speak his specific dialogue. Sure. And when he doesn't find them, then it just, like, falls apart. Like, Donald Sutherland is doing a good job in this movie, but he is not really being in this movie at the same time. Like, he's giving it gravitas, and yet he's also, like, kind of just trying to make his own thing. And I understand why so bothered him. Yeah.
The JJ thing is an interesting, you know, connection too, because I feel like, and again, like, who really knows, but JJ doesn't certainly have the reputation of being as precious about his words as the other writers, the aforementioned writers that we're speaking of, the Sorkins, the Whedons, the Amy Sherman-Palladinos, the people where there is a very sort of theatrical, almost iambic pentameter to the way that they want their words said. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so specific to your point, Emily, and there's so, you need to have people that can do that, you know what I mean, that dance. And it is interesting to watch this film, which doesn't seem particularly interested in those things. And that's not to say that there isn't a deep bench of great actors in this movie, because there actually really is. And I actually think that a lot of these people give great performances, but it is sort of antithetical to everything you're talking about, which is that you're getting the sense that they're all kind of in their own movies.
I do, you know, just to hit one more point on the show.
Sure.
I do think, you know, there's a recent episode of Succession that did a thing that surprised a lot of people.
Sure.
This is airing in 2026. They killed Logan. They killed Logan Roy. And, like, the thing that everybody reached for was an episode of Buffy. Like, that was kind of the last time a show had done
really?
That. There's
Which
all
episode
like
the body,
the body. The yeah. Body, and yeah. like, obviously, like, 6 Feet Under with Nate did some of it, but, like, the body is specifically about living in that grief space in a way that the Succession episode was. Connor's Wedding is the name of the episode. And like, it, there's just stuff that Buffy did first, and now everybody's done it, so it doesn't seem as groundbreaking. But, you know, her losing her virginity to Angel, which, like, there's problematic aspects to that metaphor, and then him, you know, becoming a monster. But also, like, you know, the big bad thing and the twists of, you know, who's the twists of various characters, and, like, the mayor and Faith and all of these things. These are not unprecedented in human storytelling, but TV hadn't, like, done them in that way before. And I think, like, I mean, the most obvious example of how Buffy changed everything is that Shonda Rhimes watched a bunch of it when she had a kid and was like, I think I should do that in a hospital. And that became like one of the biggest shows of all time. So,
right. And I think that even before, I mean, the body is, that comp is so interesting because of that grief space, but that idea of like killing a major character in the middle of a season, that comes as early as season two. I mean, or if you're an Eric Balfour fan, in the pilot of Buffy, you know what I mean? Like kill someone that you think, us, but like the, killing someone that you think is going to be a main character in Eric Balfour in the pilot of Buffy, or in Jenny Calendar in season two of Buffy. And not only does she dies by the hand of like the romantic lead of the show. And that like that moment, that episode, passion, that rocked my entire world as a teenager. Like I'm still not over it because I was like, you're not allowed to do that. Like legally, you're not allowed to do that. And Joss is like, watch me do it again and again and again.
Well, that's
and upset you every time.
The Patreon episode that I was referring to was about Becoming part one and part two and comparing those two episodes. And listening to Jared and Keeley talk about how it fucked them up on a level that even to this day, they just can't really process. Like as a teenager, seeing her kill Angel, and even watching it, you know, through my prism of what have you, not being the biggest, the fans that you guys are, even I was just like, this must've been pretty fucking crazy to watch live.
And then Sarah McLachlan like kicks in and she puts on the sad overalls and takes the bus out of town. Are you kidding me?
The first episode I ever watched was the episode where Angel goes evil. And like, I had no context for it, but I was like, this fucking rocks. This is great. I think there is a certain kind of heightened emotionality that particularly hits teen girls and teen queer kids that Buffy just like nails to the wall in a way that I think is when you're in it, you're fucking in it. And then all those people went up to create television shows. So,
and something that I think is interesting, I mean, like to compare Buffy the show to Buffy the movie, like there's, you know, there's a million differences. And I think all the things that we are saying about the way in which this isn't like true to the core of Joss is true. But also this is a character at a very different point in her arc, right? We are watching her and, you know, you mentioned Becoming, like they retread this a bit in the show and then in the comics again as well. But like, you know, her coming to Sunnydale in the show is her already having learned about her identity and like gone through something and being aware, watching her go from, you know, her completely privileged pillowed life through this awakening is a different story. And so she's a different character. Also, she's played by Chrissy Swanson, which is just a different prompt altogether, I would say.
Problematic.
Yeah, exactly. But I think something that I thought was really interesting looking at the original script that Joss wrote versus what eventually made it onto screen is like the Swanson version of Buffy that we get is much more likable than the person that Joss put on screen in the first place. Mm. Like he and like, is that, I mean, I hate talking about likability in women in general. And I hate when other people do it too, but I just think what the changes were trying to tell us was that this was a part of her always. And she is sort of like awakening to that versus like, let's do a complete 180 on a complete 180 on a character. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, you know, again, to sort of return to the movie, there's a lot of stuff that he does in the TV show over much greater spans of time that happens in this movie in like an hour and a half, you know, the fact that the mentor figure is this top of act three death, the, you know, the fact that she does, like, there are these character arcs, like there's like 16 Cordelias in this movie. Like one of them is played by Hilary Swank, who's not who I would necessarily cast in that part, but you know what? She's having a ball. So
she's
this cast is stacked. But yeah, there is this thing where like the movie feels like this imperfect thing, representation of what he eventually was sort of trying to make on television. And it feels like the history of Joss Whedon in the movies outside of that first Avengers movie, which I think is pretty great, is like studios like coming in and fucking with his shit and then him being like, brr, 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 and then somebody leaks his Wonder Woman script online and everyone's like, what the fuck is this?
I do want to sort of, I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, because it feels like the Joss, and I hate to attribute this just to him because I don't think it's just him. You know, Joanna, you referred to Williamson as well, which I think was also very much a part of it, but snark in replacing of jokes seems to be a thing that has become very prevalent. And I bring this up just because I went to see Dungeons and Dragons recently, which was great. And
good movie. Good movie.
Good movie. Super fun movie. That movie's got actual jokes. Like, that movie is sincere, and that movie isn't winking at the audience, and that movie isn't doing what I feel like is kind of everywhere, which is letting itself off the hook and allowing the audience in by saying, like, we know it's a joke. Like, we know this is silly. You know, the Deadpool kind of meta-ness that seems to be very pervasive. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think on the Whedon-Williamson front, what Emily already raised, this idea that, like, that snarky, quippy dialogue is being used in teenage soaps. Like, Buffy's a genre show, but it's a teenage soap. Sure. Dawson is to its bone a teenage soap, you know, and so that heightened emotionality, like, there's a lot of sincerity, there's a lot of emotion, sure, like, racing through those stories. But then when you watch some of, like, Williamson's movies or whatever, like, that's not in there. He's not operating the same space. And I think I was thinking about that, and when I was watching the movie this morning and thinking about the casting of Luke Perry is really interesting, because the casting of Luke Perry changed, like, the whole movie, because it was going to be a smaller independent film, and then they got Luke Perry, and all of a sudden the studio's like, oh, we're going to put some money behind this because you got Dylan McKay. But, like, he's kind of trying, because this is something he did very well, he's kind of trying to bring some of that to this. So, like, when they're slow dancing, he's, like, trembling, like, he's trying to, like, bring this deeper emotionality to this very light and fuzzy kind of space. But can I please read to you the description of Pike that was in Joss's script?
Absolutely. Oh,
yeah. Versus what we got. So he called them, where is it? Let me find it. One second.
Worries.
Okay. Punked out and not currently attending high school. Pike is long and lean, has short hair, spiked, and a taste for long coats and black. So Joss wanted Spike and they gave him Dylan McKay instead. And I love Luke Perry in this. I actually think he's great in this movie. Yeah, but if I'm Joss and I'm like, and I had Spike in mind and they gave me Luke Perry, I might also be mad.
Yeah, no, I totally hear that. And it is funny how, because there's the whole Angel versus Spike thing in and of itself. There are people that are obviously Team Angel, people that are Team Spike in terms
Team
of
Riley. Team Riley. Team Riley.
Emily, this is like the worst thing I've ever heard you say.
I'm very much Team She Should Be With None of Them. But.
Yeah.
Team Buffy. Yeah. But I do think that it is the Luke Perry thing is interesting. So Beverly Hills 90210 premieres in, is it 89 or 90? I think it's
90.
Okay.
I think.
So it's in its probably its second or third season. It's obviously this big hit. So to get Luke Perry was like a big get. And I do imagine too that, you know, I don't know, getting the teen heartthrob from a television show in your movie has its own thing as well, right? Where you're just sort of like the legitimacy of someone trying to go from television to movies and all the sort of things that come with that. But he is really good in this movie. He's very sincere in this movie. So he has really great chemistry with Christy Swanson. So, like, it's kind of a win-win, but I do understand how if you're Joss, you're probably like, but it's not what I wanted. I don't know.
What I love is, like, I was reading some old interviews that Luke Perry gave around this film, and it's very sweet. Like, he wanted to do this because he wanted people to, like, not just see him as Dylan McKay, which, sure, like, didn't ultimately work out for him, I think. And by the way, like, rest in peace, Luke Perry. Yes. I met him once. It was, like, one of the most thrilling things of my life. I didn't know him, obviously, sure, but, like, I don't usually get starstruck because, you know, we've just done a lot of this in our lives, but, like, sure, it was Luke Perry. It's like, but First of all, he refers to Pike as the damsel in distress of the movie, which I love.
It's true.
And then he also talked, there's this quote in the LA Times where he says, like the first day of shooting, about 300 people showed up, mostly screaming girls. Rutger and Donald weren't working there that day, and I was so glad because I didn't want these two well-established, respected actors to walk on the set and think, oh no, we're making a movie with Frankie Avalon. And so, like, Luke Perry is, like, so aware of, like, who he is in all of this and not wanting to be that and, like, wanting to impress Rutger Hauer and Donald Sutherland, and I find that very winning.
I mean, it is, and it's not surprising to a certain degree, right? I mean, they've probably got, let's say, 25, 30 years in between them, something along those lines. And I imagine that as a young up and coming actor, you'd want to impress both these people. Donald Sutherland clearly was unimpressed on the set, no matter what you did.
In general, yeah.
So there's that. But what were you gonna say, Emily?
I want to speak a little bit to the mm-hmm. snark joke divide. Because that's a thing that people say, and I don't always know what they mean by it. You know, like, I think I've sort of come to understand that what they mean is using a line that's phrased like a joke and that the actor says like a joke, but actually is just kind of a reference to something. And I think,
yes,
I think the difference between Joss Whedon at his best, he's not always at his best, and a lot of the people who copied him is he never does that. Like, he's always very good at, like, having mm-hmm. layers to things, at making them actual jokes. Like, I used to obsessively read Jane Espenson's blog.
Sure.
She's a longtime writer on Buffy, and she would talk about their process for writing jokes on that show, and it was, like, as rigorous as, like, a sitcom room. And, like, I do think that there is, and again, I think that Luke Perry is a good window into this. There is a sincerity to everything mm-hmm. that happens in one of these scripts. I think there's a sincerity to everything Kevin Williamson does. He's someone who's been bad a lot more often than Joss has been bad, but, like, you know, you watch, like, Scream, there's a sincerity to that movie, like, deep down beneath all the gore and pop culture jokes. I think there is a thing that happens. It's kind of the same thing as the divide between The Simpsons and Family Guy, where Family Guy comes on and is like, you can just say the thing and people will laugh if they recognize it. And of course it works. So, like, I think there is, Luke Perry's such a good example of this. And I think, honestly, Christy Swanson is also giving, like, a very sincere performance in this.
I agree.
You know, there is a layer to this script and to the direction of it that I think is capturing something real about the teenage experience. It's just maybe not, you know, doing it the best it possibly could.
On the Buffy joke front, one of the clearest writer's room lessons I ever learned was, listen, I think it was either Jane or Marty Knoxon on one of the, like, commentaries on a Buffy episode. And they were describing how they were putting together the scene, like, one of the scenes in the library where Buffy's friends are all talking or whatever. And Joss came in to, like, go over a script. And he, like, called out a line. He's like, what is this line? And they're like, oh, no, it's a joke that, you know, we gave Willow. He was like, that's a Xander joke. And they're like, okay, yes, Willow didn't have enough lines, so we just gave her a Xander joke. And he's like, you can't just give Willow a Xander joke. Like, you just can't, like, you know, and so that, I think, is, like, the difference to partially Emily's and both of your points of, like, good of Joss versus people just trying to imitate Joss. You know what I mean? Cause, like, there are Joss imitators where everyone just sounds the same. Mm-hmm. And that's not sure. what he does, you know.
I think that to try to unpack sort of what you're both saying, but also Emily, the whole, like, what are people saying when they say snark instead of jokes? I do think part of it has to do with a mutation of Whedon and Williamson. And I would even go as far as to say Dan Harmon now, where, like, you're in this place of, like, metatextuality that requires very specific writing. Like, you can't, ultimately, I think Deadpool's the thing that tipped it in a lot of ways, because Deadpool went to sort of this place of, quite frankly, literally winking at the camera, like, literally talking to the camera and being like, do you see what I'm doing here? And that, I think, at least for me personally, and it feels like to some degree you're seeing it in some of these Marvel films as well, where it's like we've kind of got lost a little bit in all of this. And I think that's why something like Dungeons and Dragons felt so fresh in its own way because it felt like it's not doing that. Like, I agree with you, and I certainly didn't mean to suggest that that Kevin Williamson or Joss Whedon weren't thoughtful about their jokes and weren't sort of making sure that there was some, you know, substance to what they were saying and that it meant something. I think we've weaponized it in a somewhat kind of shitty way.
I do really think it's the MCU, specifically
sure.
post Age of Ultron. Like, certainly I'm not saying like there's a lot of great movies in there.
A lot of great movies.
You know, Whedon comes in and like does Avengers and then kind of oversees the writing for whatever phase two. Joe and I would know.
Phase two.
And like that culminates in Age of Ultron, which is a movie I'm endlessly fascinated by and think is like,
it's
you
weird.
Know, kind of a, I, it's kind of my favorite.
Of course movie. It is. The most it's Emily
not,
take.
It's not actually like, you know, obviously there's better movies, but like I love watching that movie because it's so fucking weird. But like, and then the next, you know, he steps away because he and Marvel, you know, come to hate each yeah. other. And but they continue to do the thing. And I also think it's yeah. Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. is sure. maybe the best actor alive at like delivering that Whedon thing.
Sure.
But like, you know, the thing he's doing where like, he can be like, he's standing right behind me, isn't he? And he can make it funny. Yeah. Like they just decide everybody should be able to do that. And you're kind of like seeing the offshoots of that now in the MCU movies that feel kind of focus directionless without focus. A lot of them are being written by Rick and Morty writers, which is like
yeah, which is a part of the Dan
a show thing, yeah right? Which is yeah. a show that is so like you know, there's been good stuff in there still, you know, but it is very much like his footprint looms so large because it became the default dialogue style of the biggest sure. movie franchise of the 2010s.
Totally.
I call it the Rick and Mortification of the MCU, but like yeah. the the Downey Whedon like 1-2 punch is so interesting. There's like this story that Whedon likes to tell about being on the set of Avengers, and like so Whedon went through, as a lot of Marvel's writers have, like pretty nasty arbitration because like a different writer had been working on the Avengers script for a long time, and Joss is like, I threw it entirely out. He threw it mostly out, but like he wanted solo writing credit right on this. I think they wound up giving Zach a story by credit. But anyway, he's on set. Robert Downey Jr. loves to improvise. Joss, being very particular about his language, doesn't love it when actors improvise. So the compromise they come up with is like Joss would just write 6 lines and then Downey could pick which one he was gonna say. You know what I mean? Like if a line wasn't working for Downey, in general, if a line's not working for Downey, he will just make up one that he thinks works. Mm-hmm. And since that bothered Joss, he was like, let me give you options and then you can just go for there. But to Emily's point, like that Whedon shadow and that Downey shadow, which is, you know, what Downey can do is be both glib and very sincere at the same time. You know what yeah. I mean? And his absence is being sorely felt in the MCU. Absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's, as I think is Chris Evans. But all that being said, I do think that Joss's voice in this film can be felt, obviously. And I think it's interesting, Emily, because we've stumbled upon this a couple times now, and I imagine we will continue to as we keep going down this road in 92. But like, you know, we talked about it with Reservoir Dogs. We're inevitably going to talk about it with Strictly Ballroom. You know, we're talking about it here, where like the kind of the moment, right? The first thing that these huge auteurs do that kind of that you look at and be like, is this kind of the skeleton key a little bit? Like, can I kind of see all of their work through this prism? And this isn't 100% Joss, as we've discussed. He didn't direct this, and there's any number of things that are different from what he originally wrote. But like, there's a good swath of Joss here with which to kind of be able to pull stuff from. Let me give a little bit of context 41 minutes into this episode so that, you know, people who haven't seen this film, for
Buffy and she's a vampire. What more do you need?
Let me just do this. For Buffy Summers, played by Christy Swanson, nothing is the same after she meets Merrick, played by Donald Sutherland. Merrick tells the team that she's been sent to train her to fight vampires and proves himself by displaying his supernatural powers. Buffy is a quick study and soon takes fellow student Oliver Pike, played by Luke Perry, under her wing. repeatedly saving him from fierce bloodsuckers. But when a very dangerous vampire played by Rutger Hauer gets rambunctious, she must go to war again. Buffy the Vampire Slayer opened on July 31st, 1992, against Death Becomes Her, A League of Their Own, Sister Act, and The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $16 million on a $7 million budget. It has 36% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 43% from audiences. The LA Times said, while it would be a mistake to oversell Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the sad and or happy truth is that you could do a lot worse on a warm summer night, which I think is faint praise. Variety said a bloodless comic resurrection of the undead that goes serious just when it should go wild and woolly. And the New York Times said a slight good humored film that's a lot more painless than you might have expected.
I'm guessing Ebert did not review it.
He did not review this film. That's why I do not have a Roger Ebert review.
That's the thing is, like, you know, every year in the summer, he'd just take a fucking week off because he was going on vacation, which is good, like, for him. But it would just be like, and then he just didn't review Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And you're like, I wonder what he thought. He never put it in his great movies column. Like, he should have.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it is interesting to see, first of all, to look at the weekend that it's in with some heavy hitters. I mean, Death Becomes Her, League of Their Own, Sister Act, Mighty Ducks, which didn't actually come out this weekend, but that's an ongoing joke. I do think that, I'm sorry, Emily, to pull back the curtain on our Mighty Ducks
has always been and always will be. I hope if we do podcasts like it's 2023, you continue to be like, absolutely, and of course, the Mighty Ducks.
The Mighty Ducks.
It's just always in theaters.
Yeah. I do think, though, you know, I was thinking about, we did this episode earlier, Emily, but Dracula comes out in the same year as this. Bram Stoker's mm-hmm. Dracula comes out in November of this year. Kind of crazy to think that these two vampire movies actually mm-hmm. exist within the same 4 months. It really is. And it's not to say that Dracula wasn't successful. It was. But both of these films in their own weird way created a whole new sort of take on horror to some degree, right? I mean, this is trying to thread that horror comedy thing, which, you know, really, once Scream comes out, is really the game changer. But still, like, I do feel as though there is a little bit of symbiosis there. But, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula is also about legitimizing these horror films by putting the author's name in front of them. So all of a sudden, everything feels like it's legitimized. But it is just interesting to sort of think about, and again, I wasn't as cognizant of filmmaking at the time. I was only 12, but I'm curious as to sort of what you guys think of where horror is at this moment in 92, where it's going to go, because obviously once, I mean, I don't know that Jurassic Park is the end all and be all, but like there are some seismic, huge studio blockbusters that are going to come out and kind of decimate this genre in its own way and kind of push it to the side a little. But I mean, where do you guys come out on sort of where Buffy falls in the horror genre?
That's a great question. I'm not like I would never claim to be a huge horror sure. scholar, but I did just recently on another podcast I do, Trial by Content, we did 3 weeks of zombie movies.
Oh, nice.
And it was fascinating to us how dry the 90s were for zombie movies.
Oh yeah.
Like, and we were trying to think about like culturally what was going on at the time that the 90s were so dry for zombies. And one of my co-hosts had this whole theory about like a Democrat being in the office versus a Republican being in the office, and like all
there
this
could be something there.
But I think,
because like zombies don't make a comeback until 28 days later, really, right? Isn't that one kind of
yeah. And it's part of it, I think the kickstart of the second wave of zombies or whatever is 9/11. And 9/11 brings in a lot, like kicks open the door on a lot of genre content on Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, like blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And so the horror space, I think we're still coasting off the fumes of the 80s into the 90s.
Sure.
And I think this just open. I mean, like, it's so funny. I don't think of Bram Stoker's Dracula as a horror movie, but of course it is. But like, I think of it as a literary adaptation, and I'm sure Francis Ford Coppola would as well.
Sure.
And then this doesn't seem like a horror movie. This seems like a B monster movie comedy sort of thing. And so I do think it feels again like kind of dry until Scream comes in. So I don't know.
No, totally. Because I do feel like you've got the 80s. Sorry, Emily, didn't mean to cut you off, but the 80s, you have sort of the you know, a million Halloweens, a million Nightmare on Elm Streets, a million Friday the 13th, all that kind of stuff. And then that's kind of done. So there's this kind of fallow period where the studios are trying to figure out like what is next in horror. And obviously it's Scream, but go ahead. Am I sorry?
I think the 90s are the worst. This is probably why you don't want to leave the 90s in future seasons. The 90s are the worst decade for horror. Like,
yeah, I don't
in
like
the
horror movies.
In the studio system. Mm-hmm. Like we watched Candyman, which I think is an all-timer. Like that's, you know, I think that's the best horror movie released mm-hmm. this year. It's also kind of the one pure horror movie. You know, this mm-hmm. is like, obviously there are others, but like, you know,
yeah, we
Buffy,
got Dr. Giggles. We got that to look forward
we
to.
We got Dr. Giggles to look forward to.
What's
like,
happening?
But like, there's just, yeah, we're just in this space where so much horror in the 80s was a specific reaction to the Reagan deal. And like, Clinton just doesn't inspire that same like level of reactionary stuff. You know, the popular theory, which Joanna probably alluded to, is that, you know, vampires are popular when Republicans are in office right. because we're all scared of blood sucking fiends who want to like take all our stuff. And zombies are popular when Democrats are in office because, you know, there's a fear of having to be the strong individual who's like standing up against just enormous groups of people. And like it kind of plays out like Walking Dead is popular when Obama's in office and all of these things. But it's very much like the 90s because we're in this weird cultural malaise after the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. There's just like not a lot of fodder for people to make horror movies about. And it's really, you know, it really becomes the second wind comes from Scream, and Scream is very much like, we're just going to like do a commentary on horror. And Buffy is kind of doing that. Like this movie is kind of playing around with tropes in a similar fashion to Scream without actually being Scream. But yeah, like I struggle to find a lot of good, pure horror movies in the 90s. I struggle to find a lot of good movies that have horror elements in them in the 90s.
I think what's really interesting about this year, 92, you mentioned A League of Their Own and Sister Act, and this is also Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman and Batman Returns. This is also yep. like single white female. Like there's a really interesting like female protagonist or female antagonist sure. thread going on in this year, and it's this pre Spice Girls sort of girl power thing where it hasn't been quite commodified and packaged yet. But like what I love about this movie, this Buffy Vampire Slayer movie, is like the whole joke, quote unquote, is, you know, Joss is like, usually the blonde girl walks into a dark room with a vampire and she dies, and I want her to walk into a dark room with a vampire and kick butt. Like, so the whole joke is like, she's a girl, but no one ever says that in the movie. There's never like a heck yeah girl power moment in the movie that's like overt in a way that makes me cringe. And that's something that I, you know, the sort of like Avengers Endgame sort of moment that they mocked on The Boys, like stuff like that really bothers me. And so I love that, like, I don't feel pandered to. And what I like also is that I don't think they really do this in the Buffy TV show. Like, you know, her having a win with the hairspray, like her girlishness being an asset for her, you know, she goes through this transition. She starts wearing like flannels and boots and cut off jean shorts and like stuff like that. She's moving away from mall culture, but the fact that like mall culture is like part of what helps her win in the end, her keen fashion sense, like 10 out of 10, no notes. I love that. So
Emily?
Yes, absolutely. No, I did want to just briefly shout out Silence of the Lambs, which of course is yes. the cultural horror juggernaut of the 90s, a fantastic film, and like inspires 10 zillion serial killer movies, which are
sure.
much less good. I think there is something about this movie. And I think one of the interesting things about Whedon's quote unquote feminism, which there's a lot to unpack mm-hmm. there, but one of the things that's cool about it is that he doesn't ever, almost never specifically, is like, this is a moment of feminism. He's just like, he presents Buffy as someone who is capable of handling herself, even in this film, which is kind of a prototype of everything he's going to do, and then doesn't belabor the point. So that, yeah, kind of the joke is just, oh, she's a girly girl and she's killing the vampire. But like, he's very clearly clued into, and that's awesome, as opposed to like, isn't that funny? And I think that's like what makes his, again, quote unquote, feminism go, and like what won him so many fans. And then, you know, there were limits to that approach.
I do want to sort of unpack the Valley Girl thing for a second, because it is something that, you know, I watch this and it's hard not to see Cher from Clueless a little bit in Buffy. I know that obviously it comes out later, but there is sort of this, the mall culture of the 80s bleeding over into the 90s, and sort of that, forgive me, but like ditzy girl with a heart of gold, you know what I mean? Wants to be a better person, longs to be a better person, is trying to sort of figure out how to be, an individual, all those sort of things mixed into all of this, which I do think obviously was kind of weirdly prevalent at the time. Like, I don't really know how to explain it outside of the fact that it feels like, as I was watching this, I was like, yeah, I feel like I've seen this sort of prototype or this archetype used a fair amount. Do you think that's just like, that's just a teen trope, I guess, that they kind of go back to?
Well, we don't really do it anymore, is what it was interesting to me watching this, is I was like, wow, the concept of Valley Girl was so important to the culture when I was growing up, and it's just gone the way that quicksand is gone, you know? And so, like, I think that, I mean, you're referencing seminal works such as Beastmaster 2, I assume, when you're talking about the, like, Valley Girl with the heart of gold who wants to be a better person. Sure. But it was a thing. There was a thing, you know, like, a few of those, like, movies from the 80s that I love to watch, like Beastmaster 2 or mm-hmm. like He-Man, is like, you know, they would lean on, it was totally hilarious and tubular when like a Valley Girl bumps up against, like, you know,
but seriously,
Conan the Barbarian.
But every teen movie has that that character, right? It's just there was a moment when all of a sudden they became the protagonist.
What are more modern examples?
I'm thinking, well, no, I'm thinking about like your Fast Times at Ridgemont High, your various sort of teen comedies at that time always had these characters in the background or part of your ensemble. This just makes her the protagonist, right? And then same with Clueless.
Obviously. I think the crossover moment is the movie Valley Girl, which is about a Valley Girl.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you might be right. You might be right. I mean, it is, it's more about Nicolas Cage pretending he's a vampire, but yeah.
I think to Emily's point, like this idea that character was a punchline and now we're taking them seriously.
Yeah.
And like respecting them as a human who deserves to be taken seriously.
Sure.
And can kick ass. That's great. I don't know. It's so interesting. The distinction between the way in which.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Joss writes about this character in a way that he didn't, like, she's a bit more objectified in his version of the script than she is in the final version of this movie. And I think he had sort of washed some of that out of his system by the time that he got to the TV show, though obviously not in his Wonder Woman script. But like, I love, you know, that like disastrous vulture profile of Joss Whedon. One of my favorite lines that Lily Shapiro wrote in there was, she was like, Buffy is someone like that he wants to be and wants to fuck. You know what I mean? And I think what's true about Fran and making this movie is that second part isn't like getting in the way of her putting this carriage together. So there's just little lines. This is the interesting trade-off. Okay, so there's a line in Whedon's script when she's, it's not the yellow leather jacket in the script, but when she's looking at the thing, the item of clothing that Hilary Swank is then going to neg her about. But, you know, she says in this, in Joss's script, she says, wouldn't I look edible and nutritious in this? And in the final cut, it's, wouldn't you guys love me in this? This is the interesting thing, because Joss's line is better. It's zingier. It's more fun. You know what I mean? But like, wouldn't I look edible in this is just sort of like, yeah. I mean, maybe in a vampire movie, it's just funny, but like, when you guys love me, there's just like a slight difference in that, that mm-hmm. that you see it sort of smoothed out in a few, then there's still mention of Yabo's defying gravity that's in the final script. So I don't know.
And also, lest we forget that one of her superpowers is her menstrual cramps.
PMS.
Listen, we've all been there before.
I only bring this up just to say that I do think, I just to talk about sort of the differences also performance wise between Christy Swanson and Sarah Michelle Gellar. Obviously, Sarah Michelle Gellar is iconic beyond iconic at this point in the role, right? So it's almost an unfair fight. But I do think that Christy Swanson, despite the fact that I do feel like this movie's a breezy 86 minutes with credits, my assumption is that there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. It certainly at moments feels like there's just stuff that's being truncated. But I do think that Buffy's arc is pretty intact. And I do think that Christy Swanson does bring, she's funny and she's genuine. And I buy her. I will say that my biggest beef with this movie is that the fight scenes are awful. Like there is
so
they
bad.
Are bad. They're just, there's no energy, there's no propulsion, they're just it's just really rough. So I can't say that I necessarily felt like she was a badass. But yes, Emily,
do you think Casey in Scream is the last Valley Girl? Like she's not specifically a Valley Girl, but she like has, Drew Barrymore has a lot of that intonation and a lot of that
rhythm. She does,
and then the archetype kind of goes away. Kevin Williamson killed the Valley Girl.
But you're going to resurrect her when you write your Scream review about Casey, right?
Of the first scene, the cold open of Scream kills the Valley Girl once and for all.
Yeah, and like I also think, you know, as a woman who works in podcasting, now the thing where people talk like this a little bit, like when I did my voice training, I you know, you add in a little bit of Valley Girl to like everything you say, and then you pull back, like you overcorrect, but like, there's this fucking thing where literally any woman who's in podcasting, even if she doesn't have vocal fry, people will be like, that's a lot of vocal fry. And they just literally fucking mean you're a woman and you're on a podcast.
So irritating.
It's, I don't know how I got in this tangent, but it's very important to me to bring this up. Anyway, no, Sarah Michelle Gellar.
I appreciate it. I do think that, I mean, putting Christy Swanson's political views aside, which was not the easiest thing to do watching this film, if I'm being completely frank. Not I did find myself.
I honestly, I don't know anything about them except that I know that she's probably a piece of shit. Like I've heard people be like, oh, she says some bad things. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to look MAGA. This up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really unfortunate.
At least Sarah Michelle Gellar is like, you know, plausible deniability Republican, which is.
And I also, I respect the way that Sarah Michelle Gellar has navigated the Joss of it all. I think that she's done it quite, for the most part, respectfully of all parties to some degree. But, you know, anyway.
And I mean, she and Freddie Prinze Jr. are one of the great love stories of all time. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love their Instagram love story. My friends, Kristen and Jenny, hosted the Buffering podcast, one of the great rewatch podcasts that you should all listen to if you like Buffy. But they had a bunch of interviews with cast members throughout, and then like the Joss thing hit the fan, and everyone was just like, no, thank you. Like, don't want to talk about this huge show that was like a huge thing in my life. And it's like, yeah, really understandable, but like really unfortunate at the same time.
It's, I mean, listen, I'm certainly not defending him in any way, shape, or form. I think that, you know, it's all kind of messy, and I don't feel like we need to really do much of a deep dive into it. But I'll just say that it's got to be really hard to be a diehard fan of this show and find that you know, the separation of art and artist is everyone's, you know, cross to bear in the current, you know, pop culture landscape, and everyone makes their choices. And I imagine if I loved this show, like that it was in my bones, that I would probably find a way to try to see, not see past it, but be able to enjoy the show still. But it's got to be tough.
Well, it's also like Joss Whedon is in this uneasy space that a lot of men who made things mm-hmm. in the 90s and 2000s are, where he's done bad stuff. He's done yep. stuff that like I object to. But also, like, if he had just like never said anything, like he, like there would have been this thing where he like gradually would, and like, but he keeps like giving interviews.
It's crazy.
And
it's crazy.
He's
the,
like
the Vulture
interview.
That Vulture madness.
Profile, like, who okayed that? Oh my God.
So it, I mean, I know a little bit about the behind the scenes of that, and we can talk about it off mic, but like the thing of like where there is this thing where there's like all these guys who did bad things, and then someone will be like, well, they weren't illegal. And like, it's so many people, and you're like, and then you like, because you love Buffy and you're like me, you like are like trying to say, well, what can I find in here that's not him? And it's all him, you know. It's similarly like
season six. You can have yeah. season six when he was making Firefly. And yeah. Marty was running the show.
And listen, Firefly, a wholly unproblematic show that has
yeah.
nothing wrong with
yeah,
it.
Nothing wrong with
it's,
that
fine,
show.
It's fine. It's fine.
But yeah, yeah. I don't. I never know what to do with, you know, because I'm. I don't think you can separate art and artist. And also, like, I think that there's something in me that is like fascinated by when you know, you're trying to do that and like unable to. I don't know.
I'm
just thinking about the yeah. movie Tar.
Well, I think specifically with Joss and with Buffy, like the things that Joss has done, so directly contradict mm-hmm. what a lot of people thought of him, you know. So it's one thing to do not illegal but bad things and it to be sort of like nothing to do with your mission statement of your work or whatever, but for Joss to have created something like Buffy, which did radically change forever the way that we thought about like women, young women, and all this sort of stuff, and like the way in which like queer people latch onto Buffy and like all this sort of stuff like that, like the way that they see themselves in that story, it's it, like disappointing is too mild of a word of like of how I feel personally around it. But also, you know, you don't want to make excuses, but I also then get that stubborn like I don't want his bad behavior or his willingness to give ill-advised interview after ill-advised interview to like take this thing that is so important to me away from me, you know what I mean? Like it's as much mine as it is
yeah.
his at this point. And so that's how
and
I feel about it.
It's like it's holding the tension in your brain of like this portrayal of teen girls that he came up with, which is I think on its somewhere deep inside of it very feminist, and the guy who was like, you know, using and mistreating people, and like those are the same person, and like one doesn't overwrite the other. And I think that tension is very hard to hold in your head. And the way you hold it in your head is you sort of return to the art and you're like, this is still in there. The good stuff is still in there. But that's also, you know, the art, the actors and the other writers and the directors and, you know, Christy Swanson, a person who's completely unproblematic in every way, as far as I know, like,
oh, well, that means you can watch Mannequin 2, Mannequin on the Move, and enjoy Christy Swanson and all her finery.
Listen, no, if I had seen this movie in 1992, it would have broken me. I would have immediately begun transitioning, and like I would have lost my family. I would have like had to go live on the streets, but I would have been like, I have to be that person. Thank you, Christy Swanson. You've done nothing wrong.
No, I think, and I the last thing I'll say on the problematic Joss front is, when I rewatch Buffy, like my evolution of watching Buffy as a teenager versus watching Buffy as an adult is, and in the 90s versus now, is really pivots around the Xander character, who, mm-hmm. and this is what a lot of people go through with their Buffy experience, like that Joss thinks of Buffy as his author insert, but really Xander is his author insert, and like watching I thought Xander was just so funny and so dreamy when I was a teen. And now I watch it, I'm like, you're every problem. You're all the problems in the shape of a man. Oh, my God.
I think this is an interesting thing to talk about from a trans perspective. And I'm going to say a bunch of stuff that sounds like I'm saying Joss Whedon is a trans woman. And I don't think he is. We don't want it. We don't want it. But like, I definitely, when I watched the show, I thought I was Xander. I was like, well, I want to be Buffy, but like, she's so cool and awesome. And like, that's just a thing I can't achieve. And obviously now I look exactly Sarah Michelle Gellar, which is all anybody knows. because it's a podcast, you can't actually see me. But yeah, like there is this thing within trans spaces, especially trans femme spaces, of like this woman who is simultaneously like a love interest and like a, like, I want to be that person interest. So there's like a weird thing that gets all wrapped up in each other and gets all melded. And like the way that Joss Whedon treats Buffy is presumably accidentally, like a, just a perfect encapsulation of the way that feels. And I think that's why like I glommed onto Xander so hard. And then eventually I was like, I wish I could be Willow, which was like the third way. It was like, what if I was just a lesbian witch? And it worked.
I do think though, you know, I don't know how, I mean, I, as a writer, when I'm writing stuff, I do put myself into the headspace of these characters, right? Like on some level, there is an avatar component that comes with writing to some degree, right? I mean, in terms of, you know, I wrote a character that was, you know, I wrote a pilot for NBC that was kind of, you know, Buffy-esque. And I did find myself, wanting to be that character, right? Like I think as a writer, you kind of have to want to be all the characters in some way or another.
For sure.
So, and I'm not, again, just to be clear, not excusing anything that Joss did, but I do think that as a writer, it is sort of this thing you're doing in a weird way to kind of live vicariously through your characters to some degree. So.
And to be honest, like there's so many of these great dude writers of the 90s and 2000s who found their mouthpieces to be teenage girls, like Lindsay Weir on Freaks and Geeks is like Paul Feig being like, here's how I think about the world. And like, it is just this weird phenomenon.
For JJ,
I was going to say Felicity and JJ for sure.
Sorry. Or, you know, Sidney Bristow, his clear, like, I mean, I'm working on a book about Lost, and like, you look at that show and like, it's pretty clear from the pilot that JJ Abrams was like, yeah, Kate is my girl. And then he leaves and they're like, what do we do with Kate? Yeah. She was like JJ Abrams person.
You said that when you generously came on the Lost podcast I did, and you called Kate a J.J. Abrams character trapped in a Damon Lindelof show. I was like, yes.
That I said that? That's very smart. Good work, Emily.
Yeah.
Good work, Emily. I got to write that into the book.
Yeah, put it in the book. So good. It blew my mind. Can we talk about Rutger Hauer in this movie?
Please. Please. Yes.
Listen, he's
amazing.
Hot.
Amazing.
He's hot. I love him.
I mean,
I love it.
Paul Reubens also amazing in this movie. I mean, I remember, not to pivot from Rutger because we will go back to Rutger, but just for a quick second on the Paul Reubens thing, I'm sure we all remember when he was arrested for exposing himself in a porn theater, although I'm not sure, you know, why. Doesn't matter. Anyway,
I didn't understand what was happening. I was just like, Pee Wee Herman has been arrested for going to the movies. And I was like, people should be able to go to the movies. This seems like a little bit much.
But this was back in the day when, I don't know, people went to movie theaters and, I don't know, didn't masturbate. He got caught.
Phil, I understand now what happened, but when I was 10.
No, I understand. 10, I'm
like, I thought the whole point of going to porn theaters at the time was to masturbate. Like, I don't really
this is
understand.
Why I find it bizarre.
I mean,
but
I'm
he's
like,
famous. I think that's why. I think
who's patrolling the aisles and just ignored all the other people masturbating and was like, you, Pee Wee Herman, it's time for you to go.
I go to porn theaters for the articles.
But all this being said, it was obviously a very big deal. It was very damaging to his career as a child actor. and people were just like, this is bad. Go away. We never want to see you again. And in 92, Tim Burton puts him as the Penguin's dad. He doesn't have any lines, but it was sort of like, an olive branch and an attempt to try to get him back in the public eye. And he does this. And I remember that was a big kind of lightning rod for this film, which was sort of Paul Rubens is back. He's funny in this film, and he is very funny in this movie. He's probably got more screen time than Rutger Hauer has, I think, or it's probably pretty close. And he's just, I don't know, he's hamming it up and he's great. And I think same with Rutger.
The timeline of that is insane, though, because he was arrested July of 91 and this comes out in 92. So, like, he was freshly arrested.
Yeah, I mean, Batman Returns is June of 92.
I mean, wild. you know, let Pee-wee go free. That was a huge injustice. But
the fact that his character's name was Pee-wee as well is just like, it's all just too good. It's too easy.
I didn't watch Pee-wee Herman. I didn't have like an attachment to Pee-wee Herman, but I loved him in this movie so much. And the prolonged death scene is one of the funniest like things a young me had ever seen in her life.
And cutting back to it during the credits.
And like that was before post-credit stuff was like a major thing. It was like Ferris Bueller and a few other things, but like not a lot. And so like we thought it was just a fucking riot and we would imitate it all the time.
It's great. Yeah. It's a great bit. I mean, and it's entirely improvised apparently.
I think like every actor in this movie is kind of dialed in. Like yes. Sutherland is clearly like ashamed to be in this movie, but like everybody is like just kind of on point, and like even he's like, you know, trying something.
David Arquette also totally knows what he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, genuinely, and I don't know why, but my outside of Paul Rubens prolonged death scene, the line that I would quote from this movie all the time is when David Arquette would go, "Let me in, I'm hungry," and Luke Perry goes, "You're floating," and I don't know why, I was just like, the height of humor for me as a kid. I thought it was so funny. David Arquette's great in this, and what I love is that their fangs are like so hard to talk around. And I think they're all just kind of going with it. Rutger Hauer especially is just sort of like, I'm gonna make this part of the whole performance. But yeah, he's great. I mean, like, I knew Rutger Hauer from this before I saw Blade Runner.
As he would want it.
And I was like, I don't think I was like, it's the guy from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but like, probably, sure. I might have. But yeah, I think he's so incredible. I think that his death is lame and stupid. Yes. And I don't know, he should have died by the hairspray thing or something like that. Like, that's a way better way to kill him than what happens. But I think he's fantastic. And I want to shout out Sasha Jensen, who plays the Grueler, the basketball kid who gets turned, who does this and Dazed and Confused and then kind of like disappears. Yeah. I think he's so good in this.
He's really good.
Like, he's having the time of his life. Like, he's so good. The little bat ears that like these poor people had to put on there. Oh, it's fantastic.
I mean, he's great. And I also flagged him because I was like, oh yeah, he's great at Dazed and Confused. And then I looked him up and it's like he kind of just disappeared. But he does have the burden of just being a straight up vampire in the middle of a basketball game in broad daylight in front
of
everybody.
That rules. That's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, it does, but it's also, it defies logic a little bit.
Then you get to watch Ben Affleck just be like, and you're like, thanks, Ben Affleck.
He is like indoors, you know, he's like,
not the sunlight. That's the issue for me. It's just like, are we ever going to talk about the fact that a vampire just showed up in the middle of our basketball game? I guess we're just not.
Why would we? We should not do that.
It's crazy. I do want to say... Yes, go ahead. Sorry, Dwayne.
Well, Phil, I know you've watched some Buffy, but you're perhaps...
I've watched 3 seasons of Buffy. Sure.
Okay. Perhaps as a fledgling Buffy scholar, you will recall all the really enjoyable ways in which people explain away vampires on Buffy Vampire Slayer, like gangs on PCP or like someone falling on a barbecue fork. Like, you know, there's just all kinds of...
I love all of that. And I just wish we got one in this is kind of what I'm saying. Like, wish we got... A weird little piece of trivia is that Alyssa Milano was originally set to play Buffy, which would have been interesting. I don't know, but
I don't like it.
Hannah doesn't like it.
It's got to be. It's got to be Christy. It just does.
Yeah. She is great. I also, just in terms of some of the production of this movie, it's worth saying that they were limited to 5 weeks to accommodate Luke Perry's Beverly Hills 90210 schedule. So this movie was clearly a little bit rushed. I also just want to very briefly talk about the remake that almost happened. I don't know if you guys remember this. I have a vague recollection of it, but I guess in May of 09, Roy Lee and Doug Davison's Vertigo Entertainment were working with, and how do you, is it Kuzui? Forgive me, I don't know how to pronounce
it. It's Japanese,
the last name.
But I do not know exactly
okay. how to pronounce it. So the basically with the director and the producer of the film to try to remake the movie without Joss Whedon, with no connection to the television show. And as you can imagine, the internet was completely fine with this. There was no big deal. They were not. The fans lost their fucking minds. But it kind of kept moving along. And then I guess it was officially kind of killed in 2010. There were some rights issues or what have you. Long story short, didn't happen. And now obviously we're sort of in this post-Joss situation where they want to reboot the show. There's clearly a desire to do that, but I don't think that it certainly hasn't happened yet. There have been various attempts to do so. What are your thoughts, guys, on a reboot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Do you think they should?
They should let me do it, and they should let me make her trans. That's okay. The way to do it.
I mean, I'm in. Where do I sign for that version?
Listen, I understand that you're the head of the former 20th Century Fox Corporation, and you have all said
no such thing. But I mean, truly, do you think that? I mean, and I don't even mean a reboot revival. I don't mean any of that, because I think Sarah Michelle Gellar's made it abundantly clear that she's done with the role and she's done with the universe.
Is Christy Swanson though?
I bet she is a veil.
Why don't we do a like Spider-Man thing and just have both Christy and Sarah Michelle as Slayers from different realities?
I guess. Yeah. I I am not the Buffy stan that you guys are. So I don't want to, I'm just, from my vantage point, there's a part of me that feels like we are in a vacuum when it comes to what Buffy brought to television. It feels like what used to be a staple of broadcast TV were genre shows, genre procedural shows, soapy, what have you. And there's none of that anymore. So I'm...
Well, that's not true, because the CW is like running on this, and that's where Buffy lived, was the WB and then the CW. Like the CW has like, you know, all the Julie Plec shows that she's making and all the like, you know, and there's a lot of reboot fever over that, right? Like Charmed and Roswell and like all that sort of stuff, like rebooting the WB shows. I'm not saying I want a Buffy reboot. I think there's a higher probability that it's bad than it's good, or that it's a shell of itself. Like you can't really do it without the Jossies or whatever. Right. But I'm also, and I'm as fatigued as anyone with like unimaginative IP, like, you know, juicing and stuff like that. But I've also, there's just been enough times that someone has had a point of view with a juicy piece of IP, like Mad Max or something like that, where the reboot or the sequel or the reborquel or whatever you want to call it was like worth it. And given how many inspiring and inspired writers like feel so passionately about Buffy, I feel like maybe Emily or someone else, like someone really smart, might have a take that I'd be interested in.
Sure.
I would watch it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I would watch it.
I think that this is the kind of property where the premise is so pure that you can kind of just do whatever you want with it. Like, I think I kind of feel similarly about X-Files, though I think X-Files has way more like cultural baggage just because conspiracy theories now run our entire political system. But yeah, there's something so pure to that core that if you found the right writer who wasn't beholden to what Joss did, I think it could be really good. And like, but then you'd have to, you know, get out from under the shadow of him. And I don't know if that's possible.
Well, my big thing is just the iconography of both those shows is so ingrained in culture. Now, admittedly, like, there's a whole new generation that probably doesn't even know that the original Buffy exists or the original X-Files exists. But the idea of someone taking on the mantle of a role like Buffy or a roles like Mulder and Scully just feels like crazy to me. But I guess anything's possible. I'm certainly not saying it's impossible, but
my baby has no idea either of those shows existed.
Sure.
She's, but she's so seen fucking Babylon. Stupid. Yeah, she's seen Babylon.
So
fucking stupid. I mean, I think the way to go with the Slayer property, and the comics have done this to a certain degree, is to do backstory, like previous generations of Slayers.
Right.
Like, I think that is a safer, more fertile territory than like, let's, you know, yeah, because people will just be like waiting for a cameo or like waiting. I'm just like, get away from it.
No, it's probably right. You know, yeah.
If you could get Sarah Michelle back, which you won't be able to, the way to do it would be to do like a fucking She's the Watcher now, and there's a new teen girl she has to look out for, like that. Do the Gilmore Girls thing, but with vampire slayers.
Great. Fantastic.
And she's trans. That's how we fixed it.
I would buy this pitch in the elevator.
I would buy this pitch.
Thank you.
I am. So it was really funny because I watched this film the other day, and then Stephen Root popped up, and then I watched Succession and Stephen Root popped up, and then I watched Barry and Stephen Root popped up, and I was like, is Stephen Root everywhere?
Can I tell a Stephen Root story?
Please.
So there is this very, Joanna knows this since she's been to TCA press tour. There's this extremely strict rule. You don't take photos with talent. It makes us look unprofessional, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, sure.
And I'm a former TCA board member. I've always been like, everybody should get one exception. You know, like if Taylor Swift came to TCA press tour for some reason, I don't fucking care. I'm getting a picture with her, even if I have to, like, you know, be hauled off into the sunset or something. Like, but I actually have burned my one photo on Stephen Root. I was so excited to see him at some Hallmark event that I was like, listen, you got to get a photo with my wife. And he seemed so baffled. And I was like, oh, right, because we're not supposed to ask for photos. And I was like, but wait, no, actually, probably like Stephen Root doesn't. This isn't like 2013, too. So it's like he's not like now he's everywhere. And Libby just reminded me, he was also with his wife, Romy Rosemont. So, like, we got a nice photo, fucking Stephen Root and his wife and that's my fantastic. Wife. That's my Stephen Root story.
You should post it on our Twitter.
watching this, in which Stephen Root looks approximately 40.
Yeah.
And I was like, how long has Stephen Root been 40? he's 70. He was 41 when we met. He's 71 now. And I like didn't know that.
He's but
I,
71? 71. He does not look 71.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, he's double billing it this weekend in Succession and Barry. And the man is 71. Because watching this, I was like, oh no, he's like 40 here. How old is he now? Yeah. And this is pre, you know, pre news radio Stephen Root. So
yeah, that's why I love him.
I mean, listen, I'm not the first person to say this. And I won't be the last. Stephen, the range that Stephen Root has is kind of unparalleled. Insofar as that I find him unbelievably funny and also unbelievably sad and sometimes scary. And very like, scary. What he's done just with this, with the Coen brothers, is just sort of, it's fascinating. And my assumption is that he's probably just a super laid back, doesn't give a shit, just like it's effortless to him to do what he does. It's incredible.
Having met him, I can assure you that yes, he's like, he was just very chill. Like, I have met obviously a lot of celebrities. Sure. I love that. Like, I love that Joanna's story about like meeting someone, meeting Luke Perry and being like, oh my God. And I'm like, I met Stephen Root.
No, can I just tell you that I if I were to have ever burned my one TCA photo, which I haven't yet, it would have been on Luke Perry. We were at the Langham Hotel and like, I don't know how to describe the Langham Hotel in a way that makes it understandable to people because it's just like unnecessarily fancy in this. Like, how would you describe it?
It is a confusing labyrinth of luxury. Like, it's just. Yeah.
And Luke Perry had a new puppy and he was walking his puppy around the loop of the courtyard of the Langham Hotel. Mm-hmm. And then he came and did an interview with me and for Riverdale, of course, the seminal work. And then he was like, Joanna, you're cell phone screen is cracked. Treat yourself better. Get a new phone. And I was just like, thank you, Luke Perry. What a gemstone. That's,
can I just say, though, the selfie thing is, it's a real like line in the sand for me. Like, I've never done it. And it's not to say that I wouldn't. To your point, Emily, if I met Taylor Swift, I'm getting a picture with Taylor Swift. But I was watching TikTok the other day, and this girl was talking about how she was at a Taylor Swift concert recently. She was in the bathroom, and weirdly, the bathroom was like entirely empty because no one was there because Taylor Swift was singing and no one wanted to miss anything. She goes to the bathroom and she looks over, she's washing her hands, and Emma Watson is right next to her. And she's an enormous Harry Potter fan. And she's like, I couldn't live with myself if I didn't say something. So Emma Watson like dries her hands and she's leaving. She turns to her and she says, I'm so sorry. And I hate to ask this, but, and Emma Watson was like, I really can't give you a selfie in the bathroom. Like, it was just, so like she was, and it was, and she was very lovely and she was very sweet about it. But it just goes to show that like, we're in a weird place with these selfies in terms of like when people feel like they can ask for them. I think it's kind of amazing.
I feel like the Hallmark party was a really good spot to do it though, Emily.
Yeah.
Like That is a wild shindig every year at TCA.
A different friend of mine burned his on Kieran and Shipka. And I'm like, Kieran and Shipka's great. Mm. But you know what? It just feels like you could have gone for Stephen Root.
You know, it's funny as I'm sort of scrolling through the plot here just to make sure that there isn't anything that we haven't hit. But I do want to talk about the locations in this movie, the graveyard, the what have you, are all kind of, it is funny to watch this because this movie only had a budget of like, I think it was $7 million. And you can see that it didn't have a lot of money, obviously. But it's still location heavy, which is not cheap. But like back in the day when you actually shot stuff on location. But there's one great location, which is, I guess it's like an abandoned theme park or something.
Oh yeah, no, it's the LA Parade Floats graveyard.
Okay, They have
this insert shot that I didn't remember was there, where they just like show you the sign of where it is, and then they go into there, and that's when you get the incredible line, "I'm a god, now you're a coat rack," like incredible scene. Can I tell you about how Donald Sutherland's character dies in the original script?
Please.
So like Rutger Hauer has...
He dies at
like,
the end in the original script or...
No, in a similar spot. Okay. But Buffy's far away with mm-hmm. Pike. She's not like right there. Sure. And Lothos has him like mesmerized the way that he does and sort of stuff like that. Like, Merrick is like giving this whole speech. There's a lot of Lothos and Merrick speeches that are cut, like so many. He's giving this whole speech. He's got the gun behind his back. And then Lothos is like, well, maybe you think you could stop me with that gun in your hand, you know? And he's like, maybe I can. And he's like, you know, once you've been my servant for 100 years, you will like learn. And then Merrick shoots himself in the head to like prevent himself from.
Oh, turning. He kills himself.
Yeah. So that Lothos can't turn him into a vampire. And then Lothos is pissed about
that's
that.
That's better than it what is, we got. don't you think?
I mean, all of the staking. Maybe the best thing that this movie does is teach Joss Whedon that you need to have some kind of special effect when you stake someone. Yes. Otherwise, it looks super stupid.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's just a lot of people. I mean, that's why the Paul Rubens thing is so funny, because like he's just at least acknowledging how dumb this whole thing looks. But yeah, it's crazy. The end of this film, it kind of has like, I don't want to say one too many endings, but it does feel like it has kind of too many endings. When you get to the dance and the dance is being sort of attacked by all these, a baby has entered the chat.
Hi. Oh my God. What a face. Hi.
She just loves looking at people on screens. It's her favorite thing.
Look at your face. A really good face.
A very good face. Look at those eyes. Aww.
She doesn't fucking know who Buffy is, though. So
no, but she will.
What a total
I'm sure
dummy.
Someday she'll know. The whole dance thing starts a little lame to me. Like, it slowly gets to where, like, once it's attacked, it starts to get ramped up a little bit. But before, I feel like there's a little bit of, like, I don't know, it just feels like another stupid dance. I don't know. It just didn't feel special to me. And I'm not sure how to articulate this other than the fact that, like,
you hate the environment and you didn't like the very important environmental statement that they were making with the
yeah that's what it is.
Tread on me.
why is this school called Hemery High School? I kept trying to figure out if that's a reference, and it's just like, but the only thing you find if you Google Hemery is Hemery High School from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Joss, come on the pod, explain this to us, and then we'll interrogate you.
Not come on the pod. We are. I don't need that in my life. But I'll just say that I liked once we got into the bowels of the school, and like it had just a little bit more atmosphere, and it was cool. And you know, there's the, as you mentioned, the aforementioned hairspray thing, which is a cool beat. I liked all of that. And obviously, I love the Ruben stuff. But then to what you mentioned earlier, Joanna, when Lothos shows up again, and then you have like this, again, as we said, bad fight scenes, just like very brutal bad fight scenes. And then like he just dies and like covers his head with his cape.
Yeah, there's no cool thing. There's nothing that she does is tied to her character development at all in her win. And that's a real failure for me of the script there. It's just sort of like it needs, for your hero to triumph, it needs to be connected to like some big character growth moment for them or something that they've learned along the way or something like that. And for her, it's just like another fight that's somehow lamer than like a previous fight that she had. I do love the vampire seniors. Like, yes, I invited them. They're seniors. Like, that's fun.
That was great. I mean, Hilary Swank is good in this movie.
Yeah, she's really fun.
When is she the Karate Kid? Is that, I think that's like 93 or 94?
That is not the question I thought you were going to ask me. I thought you were going to say, like, 94. Boys Don't Cry or something like that. I didn't know you were going to
bring
up
Boys Don't Cry because that's 99. I'm not.
I know you're going to bring up the seminal Karate Kid.
Because she's in the Karate, hold on, now I'm looking it up.
I think it's 94.
Is it? I think. Yeah. And it's the new Karate Kid or the next Karate Kid?
The next Karate Kid.
Next Karate Kid. Okay. 94, you're right. So 2 years after this, she's the titular Karate Kid. Yeah. So, you know, I liked the seniors bit. I liked that it feels a little, it has at least some fun once there's like vampires to be fighting and all that.
Yeah.
And then Luke and Chrissy take off on a motorcycle. I mean, what's not to love?
I like the line where Luke Perry's like, Buffy, you're not like the other girls. And she says, that's just it. I am. And you're like, Joss thought he was onto something here. Yeah. But also like that, like the rest of the movie hasn't grounded that idea in anything. No. So like, it feels to me like that's kind of ground zero for where the TV show is going, but also within the context of this movie, it's kind of a hilarious non sequitur.
That whole back and forth, like, I suppose you want to lead. No, me neither. That's not in Joss's script. That's added.
Interesting.
Listen, I gotta say, this is Emily's Proustian reverie into like outfits in movies from the 90s. Buffy's got some good ass outfits.
She's got some great outfits.
Her prom dress is so fucking good. I want that prom dress. That's what I'm wearing to my second wedding.
Ruffle ripped off or not?
Obviously.
I'm going to go in with it on, and then when I proclaim my love for my wife, I'm going to rip it off. I'm just going to be like, it's going to be a moment like your version of
breaking the light bulb or
it's,
a glass.
Yeah, it's going to be a moment of a supreme character growth for me. And that's what's important. But like I have a photo of her and her like cheerleading. She's got like a sports bra and like some wild leggings. And it's super colorful. It's super fun. I just like, you know what? Christy Swanson in this movie, my understanding is she's never done anything bad. And actually she disappeared. No. From the face of the earth in like 1999
it's weird.
Everything in this movie was just like, if I had seen this at 12, we'd be having a very different conversation right now.
I like to, in addition to her keen fashion sense, is that like she looks strong, you know.
Yes.
She like,
yes,
when yes. she does like, the fight scenes are bad, but So they got someone to do a lot of fun flips, and she looks like she could actually do that. And like, the Slayer doesn't have to have a lot of muscles because it's like a superpower thing. But you know, Sarah always looked like extremely tiny, and Christy looked like when she kicked something, it would like really hurt.
Yeah.
And I like that.
She seems genuinely athletic, is the thing. Yeah. In a way that Sarah Michelle Gellar doesn't. But I'd like to rate this movie, because Joanna, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the film that we're covering next week as well. Very briefly. So I saw this in 92. I'd be lying if I said as a kid I really got it. I don't really think that I did. I probably would have given it like a 60 back then. Before this podcast, I came into this podcast at like a 65. But I'm going up. I'm at a 72 now, because I feel like this movie is like, it's good, not great. I think there's a lot of good stuff in it. I appreciated its running time. It doesn't overstay its welcome. And I think there's a lot of good stuff in it. But yeah, I mean, she has thoughts.
She's outraged at your 72.
My apologies. Emily, where are you on this?
Oh gosh, I like came in at like a 48. Like, I don't think this is a bad movie. I also don't think it's a good movie. Like, I tend to go lower than you because I'm trying to use the whole of the scale. You know, I'm trying to like But like, talking about it, I like this more than I did. I'm gonna go up to a 53. I think a 50 is like the line between recommend and don't. This is extremely mild recommend, mostly for the outfits, but also because there's some fun shit in it. So.
Joanna, where are you on Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
As I warned you at the top, I am incapable of being objective about this. I'm going to give it a nostalgia-soaked 85.
All right. I like that. So next week, we have co-creator of Yellow Jackets, Bart Nickerson, coming on with Carrie Gallogly, a development executive at AMC, to talk about Encino Man.
What a collection of nouns.
They're all words that are truthful. I have not seen Encino Man since 92. Joanna, do you have thoughts on Encino Man? Have you seen Encino Man?
I have not seen it since 92, for sure.
But you remember it being a cultural moment, right?
I mean, Pauly Shore.
Brendan Fraser. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I don't know, it blurs with all the other Pauly Shore-ness that was happening at the time for me.
Sure.
So, yeah, I don't know that I can
speak intelligently about it
on any level.
It kind of had a moment, because at the Oscars, when Brendan Fraser and Ki Huy Quan both won, everyone was like, and Encino Man is back and it's winning Oscars. And I'm just like, okay, everyone needs to relax. Like, I know that we love nostalgia, but Emily, have you seen Encino Man?
I believe I have. This is another one of those movies where I'm like, I saw a lot of Pauly Shore movies because my sister was like obsessed with him. So I'm sure that I've seen it, but also like I have no specific memory of it.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It is interesting it made $40 million in 1992, guys. Like, that's not nothing. Like, this movie was like a thing. But you know, listen, I'm excited to watch it again. It's 88 minutes, Emily, with credits, so you know, that's, you gotta love that.
Listen, I have had my issues with us covering this year of cinema, but all these movies are fucking short, and that's great.
I love that for you, honestly. That's,
that is the beauty of 92, is that these movies did,
why
they're like,
can't they make 90-minute movies anymore?
It's crazy.
Because you gotta load in all the lore, you know, just to make sure. Yeah.
I mean, again, this is what Joss is pissed that they cut out of his script. He's like, I talked about the Watcher backstory. Lothos is rising for a reason. There's a blood pool. Like, he just took all that stuff and made it the Master in season one of Buffy. It was fine. But
I do think it is interesting. I mean, on top of the fact that movies are very long, we also have to sit through 15 to 20 minutes of trailers before we see a movie in theaters as well. So it's a whole experience.
I mean, to your point, the D&D movie, one of the biggest knocks I had on the D&D movie was that it's too long. And then if you stripped out 30 minutes out of that movie, I would say that is a solid, like, smashola hit.
I agree with you.
As it is, I'm like, I liked it, but you know, Tighten up, you know?
I felt similarly. I wouldn't say as much. I'd say like 15 minutes. But to your point, it overstayed its welcome. But by the end, I was like, I'm ready for this to be, for this to wrap up. But, you know, yeah, it's Emily.
We took the baby to Dungeons and Dragons. Like, that's a thing that we were doing for a while, is we would go on their sensory friendly screenings at the Alamo, and they would go on Tuesdays with our baby and see movies. She is now at an age where seeing a movie breaks her brain. So she could not, like, she was just overstimulated for like 72 hours after that movie. But she seemed to really like it. Then we took her to see Air, and she was so upset that Ben Affleck wasn't talking back to her. So
rude, genuinely.
I love the movies you're exposing your child to at this point. It's fantastic. Her first movie, was it Babylon? Was her
first movie was Avatar 2, The Way of Water.
Right. She loved The Way of Water.
Yeah. She took a huge dump in Babylon, which was good for her. You know, it's on brand. And that's why I love that movie so much. I got the fucking 40X experience.
The only thing that we have left to do, Emily, is you didn't give us your queerphobia rating.
Oh, on God.
Vampire Slayer.
Oh, God. I guess like a 4. It's just like there's something about it that is like, yeah, you know, kind of homophobic, but not really.
Yep.
It's like it is in that space between homophobia and camp that is like so many of these 90s movies exist. Uh-huh. So, yeah. I don't know.
Get ready for that in Strictly Ballroom as well.
Hell yeah. Love Baz.
Oh my God. The Bogo Pogo. There's a line right when she says, when like a biker guy's like, you want to feel some real power between your legs? And she's like, I do. And she steals his motorcycle. And he's like, dyke, you're a dyke. I'm telling the world. I'm like,
yeah,
that's gay rights. I'm like, this piece of shit. It's like, you're a dyke. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
It's like I gave Basic Instinct an 8 on the queerphobia scale, but an enthusiastic thumbs up of an 8, where it's just like, this is objectively homophobic, but also, you know what? It kind of rules.
That movie's insane. So like it's hard to really hold anything against it.
I was a friend of mine who I went to middle school with was over yesterday, and we were looking at our yearbooks from them. And the 1992 yearbook, the 8th grade class listed their favorites of certain things, and it is an incredible time capsule. And they did guys and gals, and like the gals' favorite actors, and it was like Christian Slater and like blah blah. And then the guys was Sharon Stone, like 3 Sharon Stones in a row, and I was like, okay, 92.
Sharon Stone would murder all of them gleefully. Like, it's just incredible to think about that's what they lusted for.
I can't believe a middle school yearbook editor let them do that. I was like, okay.
I want Basic Instinct 3 to be Catherine Trammell teaching at a middle school.
Sharon
Stone. I would watch the hell out of that. That sounds incredible. Joanna, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Buffy with us.
Where can people find you? What do you want to plug?
Oh, I work for TheRinger.com, so we do a bunch of podcasts over there, like The Ringerverse, where we talk about genre, Prestige TV, where we talk about Prestige TV, Trial by Content, where I talk about zombies. Right now we're doing, well, this is coming out way later, so it won't matter, but we debate things every week. Sure. And on the internet, at Joe Wrote This on all social media, etc.
Joanna, you're one of my favorite people to talk about dumb bullshit with. And I mean that as a huge compliment.
Ditto. I missed you at TCA this year.
Listen, I saw Stephen Root, and that was it.
That was the height.
You peaked. That's what you're getting. I mean, what are you going to do from there on? I also, Joanna, love talking about all things pop culture with you. You're one of my favorite tweeters and writers and podcasters. So thank you so much. Truly. It's been too long. So I hope that you'll come back and talk about something else with us in the future.
You know, I will. It's a threat and a promise.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. Bye, guys.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.